already lustrous presidential prospects, and the luxurious presumption that the presidency would one day come to him almost by inheritance. By the time Kennedy turned 37, he was the most glamorous public figure in the U.S., leading all polls for the nomination in 1972. Despite disavowals that he was seeking the office, one observer noted, he wouldn't be a Kennedy if his goal were not the White House. Submerging grief and self-pity in frantic activity, Kennedy's schedule was like running the Boston Marathon. On a typical day, Kennedy climbed into a leased car and set out from McLean, Virginia at breakneck speed for the Capitol, 10 miles away. A fearsome driver, already frightening the young, capable, and happy-to-be-anonymous staff, disinclined to reveal anything about a possible bid for the presidency in 1972. As Kennedy's stature rose in the Senate, in part as a leading anti-Nixon administration critic against the Vietnam War, his spirits revived as well. He had become tougher, more decisive, less ebullient since his brother Robert's death. But a general discouragement with Ted's off-hour antics was being privately expressed within the Kennedy circle. Kennedy had been drinking more heavily since his brother's death, Time reported. He has been a different and deeply troubled man, but he is far from being a drunkard. Those close to Kennedy saw signs of a recklessness out of key with his expanding presidential prospects. Accepting an assignment from Life to cover Ted Kennedy after his brother's assassination, writer Brock Brower concluded that the insecurities, fatalism, and fast living showed Ted Kennedy was seeking to escape an inevitable candidacy for president. The bad thing is the pressure everybody's putting on him that's making him come up with some pretty hairy avoidances. A member of the press entourage that accompanied the senator to Alaska in April 1969, Brower observed, "No one on board the return flight to Washington, D.C. was in any too great shape, but we were at least doing our drunken best to quell further display by the senator himself." Kennedy started drinking on the plane, pelted aides and reporters with pillows, and exhorted passengers in a chant for Eskimo power. A big, boiling broth of an Irish boy, all his anxiety clearly showing, Kennedy talked incoherently about Bobby's assassination, predicting, "They're going to shoot my ass off the way they shot Bobby." Seated beside Brower on the plane, John Lindsay of Newsweek saw another all-too-familiar pattern emerging. Kennedy was slipping out of control toward some unavoidable crack-up. "Some thought his drinking had got beyond the strains it was supposed to relieve," Brower said. "As reporters, we were going to have to say something about this distressful side of Ted Kennedy." But Lindsay made no mention of the incident in his coverage of the trip, filing notes of the incident in a confidential interoffice memorandum. In fact, for a year after his brother's assassination, Ted Kennedy got favored treatment from the press. More often than not abrupt, bland, or evasive with reporters, Kennedy was enjoying a period of journalistic grace, protected by a mantle of sympathetic coverage. Gargan accompanied Kennedy to Memphis to commemorate the first anniversary of the death of Martin Luther King Jr. Kennedy's appearance provoked a tumultuous demonstration. He was introduced as the President of the Poor People and the next President of the United States. After speaking before the Atlanta Bar Association convention, Kennedy confronted this 1972 talk, and in a rare moment of reflection, voiced his own doubts about his candidacy for the presidency to reporter Joe Mobat of the Associated Press. "The thing about being a Kennedy is that you come to know there's a time for Kennedys, and it's hard to know when that time is, or if it will ever come again," he said. "I mean, is the country going to be receptive? And if it is it really the best thing for me to do? How much of a contribution could I make? So even if the time is right, why should I? I'm not sure running around the country talking on the tough issues and waving the Kennedy flag, stirring people up, is that helpful? Bobby did it, I know, spoke right on up on what bothered him, raised all that excitement. Kennedy was unresolved about seeking the presidential nomination in 1972. Maybe over the summer, some sailing, of the family. I think perhaps by fall I'll be settled, have some idea. He didn't believe in making long-range plans. We can never know what is just up ahead that might change everything. Gargan was looking forward to a tranquil summer, after months of gut-wrenching anxiety advancing Ted Kennedy's stepped-up personal appearances. He had accepted a position as vice president of the Merchants Bank in Hyannis, which fit in with a resumed law practice, and was preparing to relocate his family to Cape Cod. No Kennedy boats had raced in the Edgartown Regatta in 1968, out of deference for a period of mourning for Robert Kennedy. But both the Resolute and the Victoria were entered in the 1969 races. An ideal situation, Gargan thought, for the boiler room to repeat the great success of the 1968 weekend. When Gargan broached the idea to Ted Kennedy, who hadn't participated in the previous year's festivities, he said, "Gee, that would be a lot of fun. Let's do it." In May, Gargan went to Edgartown seeking a cottage at South Beach as headquarters for the weekend. Everything on the water was rented. Gargan rejected other accommodations because we liked to stay over Saturday night, have a leisurely sail back, enjoy a picnic and a swim, and get into Hyannisport on Sunday afternoon. All the places I looked at in Edgartown, you had to be out by Saturday night. A cottage on Chappaquiddick was way out in the sticks, but it's a good place to get the rest you need if you're racing, rental agent Steve Gentle said. And it's not too far from the beach. More important to Gargan, we could stay through Sunday. That's the main reason I rented the place. Gargan intended to take possession on July 12th. When her mother became ill, Gargan's wife left for South Bend, Indiana. The cottage remained empty until Wednesday, July 16th, when Jack Crimmins drove a 1967 Oldsmobile Delta 88 off the ferry at Vineyard Haven. A 63-year-old bachelor, Crimmins described himself as part-time weekend and evening chauffeur when Ted Kennedy was in Massachusetts. It was a job he had performed for the past 9 years. Crimmins spent an uncomfortable night alone at the Chappaquiddick cottage, unable to sleep because an animal of some kind scratched at the front screen door trying to get in. Jack was fit to be tied about that, and terribly upset at me for having rented that particular cottage, Gargan related. He didn't like having to sleep out in the boondocks with strange animals he wasn't used to. There weren't any raccoons or skunks scratching at the door in South Boston where he lived. Gargan sailed the Victoria to Edgartown on Thursday with Howie Hall, a youngster from Hyannisport, and Paul Markham as crew. He and Markham checked into the Shiretown Inn. Gargan had secured rooms there for Ray LaRosa, a civil defense advisor and ex-fireman, and Charles Tretter, a young Boston attorney and Kennedy campaign aide. Adjacent accommodations had been reserved by Jack Driscoll, a Boston attorney and former state treasurer, for members of the crew of the Betterwin, owned by Ross Richards, longtime racing rival of Teddy Kennedy. On Thursday evening, Gargan had a vodka tonic with Stan Moore in a bar close by the Edgartown dock. A good-looking, carefree bachelor, Moore was a successful automobile dealer on Cape Cod. His Wiano senior sailboat, Uncle Benny, was entered in the regatta. Gargan asked Moore to a cookout the following evening at Chappaquiddick. Moore recalled, "The invitation was sort of hush-hush." Gargan complained of an upset stomach and feeling woozy and switched to drinking Coca-Cola before leaving for Vineyard Haven to pick up some of the boiler room girls, who had arrived on the ferry and didn't have a car. The young women were taken to rooms at the Katama Shores Motor Inn, Crimmins had reserved for the weekend, then to inspect the cottage at Chappaquiddick. On Friday, the young women shopped the fashionable boutiques of Edgartown, before they went swimming at East Beach on Chappaquiddick. Senator Kennedy was picked up at Martha's Vineyard Airport by Crimmins around 1 o'clock. He crossed over on the ferry to Chappaquiddick, changed into swim trunks at the cottage, and was driven down Dyke Road and across a narrow bridge to join the others on the beach. After a swim, Kennedy returned to the cottage, changed clothes, and was ferried back to Edgartown for a race scheduled to begin at 2:30 p.m., but delayed until the winds picked up. The young women watched the race from the charter boat, Bonnie Lisa. For Gargan, it was a lousy, uneventful sailing day. It was awful hot. Howie and I worked very hard. The Victoria finished 9th to Ross Richards' Bedouin. Stanmore sent his Boston whaler to take Ted Kennedy off the Victoria for a victory party on board the Bedouin, tied up at the dock. Richards had run out of beer. Instead, highballs were being served. Moore and Ted Kennedy had 3 drinks each. Moore remembered that specifically because they were both drinking rum and coke. Gargan stayed behind to put up the sails and batten down. Great care was taken with the Victoria, Gargan said. Ted Kennedy never allowed anyone else to sail the boat. The hatch had a lock on it, so other people couldn't get in there and fool around. By the time Gargan joined the party, the senator was ready to leave for the Shiretown Inn, checking in around 6 o'clock. Gargan ordered 6 bottles of Heineken beer from the inn's pub for a gathering on the porch outside the room he was sharing with the senator. Markham had checked out. He was spending the night at the Chappaquiddick cottage. Crimmins chauffeured Kennedy to the ferry, crossing to Chappaquiddick shortly after 7 o'clock. No one was at the cottage when they got there. Kennedy soaked in a hot tub. Crimmins made him another rum and coke. Then Gargan showed up with Markham and Tretter in a rented Valiant. Tretter took the Oldsmobile to Edgartown to buy ice, charcoal, soft drinks, and cigarettes for the party. Markham made himself a vodka tonic and chatted with Kennedy about politics. Picked up at their motel by Ray LaRosa, the girls were dropped off at the Edgartown dock. LaRosa parked his Mercury at the Shiretown Inn, then joined the others for the ferry ride across. Gargan had gone to the landing in the Valiant at 7:30 to meet the party guests. He had been waiting almost an hour, the first in a series of aggravations he would suffer that evening. Gargan was disappointed at the turnout. I thought more girls would be there. It was supposed to be a repeat performance of last summer's weekend. Dunn Gifford was invited. Jack Driscoll had been asked, so had David Hackett. Ed Martin from the senator's Boston office was expected back from Cape Canaveral after the Apollo moonshot, but had gone on instead to NASA headquarters in Houston. Gargan had also mentioned the party to Billy Cleary, future Harvard hockey coach, and Jimmy Smith of Falmouth. Local people from around Cape Cod who had worked campaigns were supposed to be there too. The party had ended up even, 6 men and 6 women, crowded into a small living room, whose counter dividing the kitchen was stocked with liquor Crimmins had purchased for a price in South Boston. Gargan had no idea what anybody was drinking. Still suffering from an upset stomach, Gargan himself was sticking to Coca-Cola, he said. I was interested in the food. That was my deal. I was doing all the preparations. As co-host, however, Gargan was displeased with the party. A lot of things were a source of irritation. I wasn't feeling well, and it was still very hot. The charcoal grill refused to start. We couldn't get the thing going at all. Gargan had provided a cassette player for the party, but everyone complained about the music selection. Tretter volunteered to go to Edgartown to borrow a radio. Rosemary Keough went with him. Then, Gargan discovered he could cook only 3 steaks at a time, so we didn't start eating until 9:45. Tretter and Keough returned after 10 o'clock with a radio. A few couples danced. Everyone sang old Irish songs, Susan Tannenbaum recalled. Most of the evening was devoted to conversation, ranging in subject from Dr. Benjamin Spock to politics, from jet noise complaints on Long Island to the senator's poor performance in the regatta. Esther Newberg teased the senator about coming in 9th, she said. He laughed and took it as a joke, blaming one of his crewmen. Despite the noise level, the evening never got off the ground, at least as far as Gargan was concerned. While the young women seemed in high spirits, the party was not that exciting. Some people were bored to death with it, Gargan observed. Paul Markham had injured his leg and was drinking heavily. I would have been drinking too if I had had his pain. Crimmins was scowling and increasingly irascible. Jack had become his usual arrogant self, as only he can get after 5 or 6 scotches, Gargan said. By 11 o'clock, we started getting the heave. Jack was coming to me in the kitchen saying, "Get all these douchebags out of here. I want to get some sleep. The last ferry leaves at 12 o'clock. I want everybody out." Crimmins had not spared Senator Kennedy his distemper either, but that was standard procedure. Kennedy and his chauffeur customarily engaged in ritual dialogues at parties the senator provoked by complaining. "Jesus, Jack, you're stiff. How am I going to get home?" Crimmins would invariably answer, "Take a fucking cab." They talked that way to each other all the time. It sounded hostile, but it really wasn't. Gargan said, "And here you have another party, and Ted is kidding Crimmins again, because Jack's had quite a few. And Jack is saying, 'Get these broads out of here. I want to go to sleep. I don't give a shit how you get home, Kennedy. I'm not driving you.' And the senator saying, 'Okay, Jack, that's what we're doing. We're going. We're leaving right now.'" Within 15 minutes of this conversation, Gargan had a vague memory of Senator Kennedy leaving the party. "I was in the kitchen area. I wasn't paying too much attention, except I clearly observed him go out the front door of the living room with Mary Jo." Gargan didn't ask where the senator was going. "I didn't question him. When he decides to go, he goes. He left when he felt like it." Kennedy didn't announce he was leaving or say goodnight to anyone. Neither did Mary Jo. Gargan thought it could have been as late as 11:50 p.m. when the senator left the party, but he wasn't wearing a watch. Maybe time went by faster than I realized, since I was cleaning up after cooking the meal. But he clearly left before 12 o'clock. I made a mental note, no particular reason, that he was going to make the ferry. When he left, the assumption was he was going to the landing, but I don't know where he went. During the course of the party, guests were coming in and out of the cottage, Gargan said. It was very hot. Some people were going on walks. It's possible the senator went for a walk before getting into the car, or did all kinds of things. I know he still had time to get the ferry, if he was going to the ferry. Gargan had spoken to the ferryman about keeping the on-time running until 1 o'clock, but I hadn't driven over to say, "We're still having a good time, do you mind waiting?" Whether I didn't have time or I forgot, somehow it got screwed around. I had in mind that if you were going to get the ferry, you had to get there by 12 o'clock. My idea was the girls had better hurry if they were going to make the ferry, but they don't leave. The main event, so to speak, has left, but people are still talking. How it drifted past 12 o'clock was just the immobile situation people get into, talking and letting the time go by. Gargan observed, "Some people at the party had quite a few, no question. Frankly, everybody's a little bombed, except for Ray LaRosa." A circumspect 41, LaRosa didn't drink. Although it was after 12, Crimmins wasn't letting up. Jack wanted everybody out. He's agitated because the girls are still hanging around. He kept saying, "Joey, get the douchebags out of here. Get them the hell out." Gargan wondered if the girls weren't leaving because of Mary Jo. They might have thought she hadn't left the party permanently and were waiting for her to come back from wherever it was she'd gone with Ted Kennedy. Chapter 13. Gargan was in the kitchen when LaRosa told him, "The senator is outside. He wants to see you." LaRosa indicated that the Valiant was parked close to a split-rail fence. Gargan was getting in the car when the senator said from the back seat, "You better get Paul, too." Gargan asked LaRosa to call Markham outside. Markham came out. He got in the car. He put his arm on the back of the front seat. He said, "What do you want?" "There's been a terrible accident," Kennedy said. "The car's gone off the bridge down by the beach, and Mary Jo is in it." Gargan recalled, "He didn't bark out any orders or anything. He made it clear he was driving the car and Mary Jo was with him. He didn't say how the accident happened. All he said was, 'There's been an accident.' That's all I needed to know. The only thing that hit my mind was go to the bridge as quickly as possible." Gargan gunned the Valiant down Chappaquiddick Road to the intersection. He made a sharp turn onto Dyke Road. He was proceeding slowly over the bridge when the senator said, "The car is there, on the right." Markham said, Holy God! Gargan expected to see an automobile that had been driven into the water with the top sticking out. He saw something entirely different. The car was completely underwater, upside down in the middle of the pond. He said, "As soon as I saw that, I got sort of butterflies in my stomach. I realized if Mary Jo was in that car, there was no hope. I said to myself, oh shit, this is over. This is done. She's gone." Considerable time had elapsed since the accident, Gargan calculated. My timing was based on the fact that the senator had left the cottage then come back. I knew from the distance he traveled that at least half an hour to 45 minutes had to have elapsed from the time of the accident to the time we got back to the bridge. The situation was hopeless as far as Gargan was concerned. There had been one solution to the problem. If a rescue attempt could have been made within the first few minutes after the accident, then maybe you've got a shot. Gargan turned the Valiant around at the beach side of the bridge, so headlights shone over the water. Their beams impaled a small house on Dyke Road, not far from the edge of the pond. Markham got out of the car. He was preparing to dive into the water when Gargan called him back. Gargan was standing beside the Valiant's front fender, taking off his clothes. He told Markham to do the same. Because if we are going to get in that car, we could get caught on the door handle or something else. Gargan stood naked on the bridge. It was a warm night. There was no breeze from the beach. Markham went into the water first. Gargan followed. All I was interested in was saving the girl. I wasn't thinking about anything else. I felt there was only one thing to do, and that was get into that car as quickly as possible. Because if we didn't, there was just no chance in the world of saving Mary Jo. Gargan swam out to the car. The water was cold but not uncomfortable. The current was tremendous. He grasped a rod on the car's undercarriage and was able to hold on and still keep his head above water. Gargan began to slide his feet down the side of the car. I was trying to feel where there was a window or a door handle, sliding down and sliding down, then letting go and trying to get underwater. Gargan couldn't do it. The force of the current dragged him away, so that he was 25 to 30 yards beyond the car before he got back under control. Gargan stationed Markham at the rear of the car to intercept him as he went by, he said. Paul had all he could do to hold on to the car against the current that was flowing through the channel. He'd been drinking, how much I don't know. But he was capable of going into the water, and on the occasions when I came up for air, he was functioning perfectly well. Gargan continued sliding his feet down the side of the car, trying to duck underwater. After several more attempts, he realized that wasn't going to work. Gargan swam to the front of the car. Working himself down the side, he found an opening he presumed to be a window and passed his body through. "Groping around to see if I could touch anything," he said later. "You had to operate by feel only. The current forced your eyes closed." The car was full of water. The current was running right through it. "There was no air inside the car," Gargan said. "There couldn't be. It was completely submerged." Gargan started losing breath. He tried to get out and couldn't. He got stuck inside. Because in turning to feel around, I'd gotten jammed in. Instead of turning again calmly, I kind of pushed myself out fiercely. He felt something sharp rake his arms and chest as he passed out of the car. He came to the top of the water gasping for air and was flung backward by the current. Markham missed him as he went by. Gargan ended 25 yards from the car. Markham swam up and grabbed him. Ted Kennedy had observed the rescue attempts from the bridge, calling out, "Can you see her? Is she in there?" Now, in the wash of the Valiant's headlights, Gargan saw the senator stretched out on the bridge on his back. Hands clasped behind his head. Knees drawn up, the senator was looking into the sky, rocking back and forth, repeating, "Oh my God, what am I going to do?" Gargan recovered his breath and swam back to the car. He conceived the idea of trying to open one of the car's doors. He dove straight down. Holding onto the side of the car, he located a door handle and yanked. The door wouldn't budge. Puzzled, because he could move the lock button up and down, Gargan put his knee against the body of the car and pulled. The door wouldn't move. Gorgon couldn't understand why he was having such a hard time getting into the car. Being buoyant and tossed around by the current made it difficult for him to gain leverage. Gorgon surfaced and sputtered for breath. Markham swam alongside him. "I can't do it," Gorgon gasped. "I just can't get into the car." Gorgon couldn't fight the current, as swift as any he had ever experienced, he said later. "The water was bad. It was rough. I almost drowned." Gorgon and Markham climbed out of the water and got on the bridge. Ted Kennedy was standing in front of the Valiant. His hair was matted and very curly, his trousers clinging wetly to his legs. He asked if there was any way Gorgon could think of to get inside the car. Gorgon said there wasn't. "I just can't believe this happened," Kennedy said. "Well, what the hell happened?" Gorgon said. "He was driving down Dyke Road," Kennedy said. "Before I knew it, I was on the bridge." The car had gone over the side. Water had risen up to his chest. "I thought for sure I was going to drown. I thought that was it. And I just gave up. And the next thing I know, I'd come to the top of the water." He had tried going back into the car to get Mary Jo out, but he couldn't do it. The only thing he could think of was to go back to the cottage to get help, he said. "I don't believe this could happen to me. I don't understand it. I don't know how it could happen." "Well, it has happened," Markham said. "What am I going to do?" Kennedy said. "What can I do?" "There's nothing you can do," Markham said. Gorgon got dressed by the side of the car. "I had one thing in mind at the time, and that was to report the accident. I didn't say that when I was dressing, but I was thinking what happened had to be reported immediately. Not in terms of calling the fire department or making another rescue attempt. There was nothing to rescue. The thing was over." Kennedy said, "Okay, take me to Edgartown." Gorgon got into the car, not thinking of anything, and the car moved forward. He saw no lights on any of the houses on Dyke Road. "They may have been lit, but I didn't notice." Gorgon drove slowly to the intersection. There was a discussion, "What do we do now?" that was done in a sort of half-trance, like sleepwalking. We were all stunned. We were all horrified. We were discussing the situation, trying to decide what to do, trying to get the story together prior to reporting the accident. "The accident is over. We're reporting the situation now." How was that to be done? Gorgon's intended destination was the ferry landing, because that was the location of safety. That's where we could get help to report this thing. In the back seat, Kennedy kept repeating, "Do you believe it, Joe? Do you believe it happened?" "We have got to report this accident immediately," Gorgon said. He suggested the senator call his administrative aide, David Burke, then go to the police. "I thought he should let the family know what had happened. And because of all these circumstances, let David Burke take care of the details. The family was in various places. We couldn't call all these people at once." Gorgon's first consideration was for Rose Kennedy, he said. "She was constantly on my mind. I didn't want Mrs. Kennedy to hear about the accident on the radio or TV, or have somebody call her up in the middle of the night to say, 'I understand your son has been lost in an accident.' She'd heard on the radio that Jack was shot. She heard about Bobby the same way. I wanted to make sure she was told Ted had been in an accident, that he was perfectly all right, and that she had nothing to fear." Markham was interjecting only an occasional, "You're right, Joe," into the discussion. He was in no position of authority with Ted Kennedy. He did not enjoy the level of intimacy with him Gorgon did. Paul was really in pain. He wasn't being as forceful as I was about reporting the accident. The senator was silent about his intentions, but it appeared he did not want to report the accident at this time. Kennedy was having alternative ideas about the situation. Why couldn't Mary Jo have been driving the car? Why couldn't she have let him off and driven to the ferry herself and made a wrong turn? Kennedy asked to be brought back to the cottage to establish the story. After a while, he could leave. Kennedy suggested that when he was back at the Shiretown Inn, Gorgon could discover the accident and report to police that Mary Jo had been alone in the car. How this was going to be worked out insofar as details were concerned, the senator didn't say. Gargan rejected the idea out of hand. Mary Jo was the only other person who could possibly have been driving the accident car. But neither the senator nor Paul Markham knew her very well, Gargan said later. Nobody had any idea if she could drive a car, or even owned a license. And besides, Gargan reminded Kennedy, you told me you were driving. Gargan doubted he could persuade the girls at the party to allow Mary Jo to take the blame for the accident, or that he could concoct a story to persuade them of the veracity of the senator's alternative version of the accident. The rescue efforts he and Paul Markham had performed had entirely changed the situation, making any revision of the accident out of the question, Gargan explained. We weren't being quiet. There was shouting back and forth. The bridge is a very public place. There was no way of knowing how many people in the area saw or heard us, how many witnesses were going to come forward to say, oh, I saw Ted Kennedy at the bridge with two other guys and the lights of the car. The senator could be placed at the scene of the accident. Making a false report to the police required a web of lies involving a disparate group of people. In addition, Gargan would be risking his integrity and reputation as a lawyer. Should he be found out, he said, I could lose my ticket, his license to practice law. To drive home the importance of reporting the accident, Gargan invoked the name of Burke Marshall. Because Bobby had said in my presence he was the most capable lawyer he knew. I was advising the senator of this because he had a very serious problem, and it was important to get who, in Bob's opinion, was the best lawyer. That's what I thought Ted needed at the time. Of no less significance, Gargan was calling upon the memory of Robert Kennedy as a reminder of the responsibility the senator bore as exemplar of those ideals. Gargan said, when we were both boys, Bob spent so much time with Teddy, working on his sailing. But more than that, to tell him, be disciplined, be courageous, meet every challenge with what ability you have. Be prepared for whatever opportunities may come your way. What Burke Marshall would advise, Gargan was certain, was for the senator to do exactly what he was insisting be done. There was constant pressure on my part, saying it over and over, that he had to report the accident at once. The discussion was at a stalemate when Gargan pulled up to the ferry landing, looking across to the Edgartown Lighthouse. Boats bobbed in the harbor's waters, but nothing stirred. The channel was smooth as glass. The ferry was moored on the opposite shore, but the dock looked deserted. Gargan had used the public telephone at the landing's ferry house that weekend, but there was no thought to using it now. He said, I was expecting to go to the police station with the senator to report the accident, once we got the story together. The discussion about what had to be done continued in the car. Gargan's sequence was to call David Burke and Burke Marshall, then report the accident to the police. This conversation went around and around. You've got to call these two people, and you've got to report this thing immediately. The senator appeared unmoved by Gargan's arguments, his silence an eloquent argument against reporting the accident. The famous Kennedy temper was stirring. Gargan had a short fuse himself. There was an edginess now to his reiteration. I was in complete charge of the situation. I was pushing that sort of thing, saying it over and over, that he had to report the accident. The senator's toleration of Gargan's nagging was wearing thin. Finally, he'd had enough. He said sharply, all right, Joey, I'm tired of listening to you. I'll take care of it. You go back. Don't upset the girls. Don't get them involved. Kennedy bolted from the car, took three steps, and dove into the water. Gargan and Markham leaped from the car after him in astonishment. Gargan was more than astonished. He was furious. As Kennedy started swimming away, Gargan said, I hope he drowns, the son of a bitch. The senator's departure was unexpected. That hadn't been discussed in advance. The senator merely left. Our conversation was cut short, Gargan said. The point was, nothing had been decided. Gargan watched the senator swim beyond the halfway mark in the channel. He wasn't concerned about Kennedy's ability to make it across. The senator's final statement before diving in the water had been reasonably clear, Gargan said. He was going to report the accident, and I was going to take care of the girls. Goggin did exactly what the statement suggested. I got in the car and started driving back to the cottage. En route, Goggin had second thoughts. I wasn't satisfied the thing for the senator to do was to venture alone to Edgartown. I didn't think it was good he was attempting to do what he was doing by himself. To Markham, Goggin said, I think one of us should be with him. We better go back to the ferry slip and I'll swim across. Markham couldn't do it, Goggin realized. His leg was in such bad shape he never would have made it. There was no sign of Ted Kennedy in the water when Goggin returned to the landing. He assumed the senator had made it safely to the other side. Goggin seriously considered swimming to Edgartown, to make sure the senator was going to do what he clearly had said he was going to do. The reason he didn't was, the senator said he was going to take care of it. Since our discussion had been about reporting the accident, I presumed that's what he was going to do, take care of it. Whatever take care of meant. Goggin was the only person on Chappaquiddick who knew the boiler room girls well, he said. I felt I should go back to the party, because I was the best one not to alarm them and to keep them calm at this time. Goggin drove back to the cottage. He did not encounter another car, nor had he seen any vehicle or pedestrian on Dyke Road, or in the two round trips to the landing. Chappaquiddick was a vacuum of stifling emptiness, Goggin said. The night was hot. There was no air. There was that deadness. It was after 2:30 a.m. when Goggin returned to the party. The cottage was dark. An outside light had been left on. Crimmins came out of a bedroom, lit a cigarette, and commenced to grumble about being disturbed. Goggin told him, Jack, it's late. Let's get some sleep. The ferry's stopped running. We'll go over in the morning. Goggin observed other guests, lying around in various degrees of a comatose state, trying to sleep. Markham collapsed on the living room studio couch, occupied by Susan Tannenbaum and Esther Newberg. They were not in a very good mood at this point, Markham said later. When Markham kind of slumped back, Newberg told him, Watch out, you're laying on my legs. I'm sorry, Markham said. I'm exhausted. You aren't going to believe what happened. Markham's slurred diction, his alcohol breath, did not encourage further conversation. Newberg got up and went into a bedroom occupied by the Lyons sisters, finding sleeping space on the floor. Goggin was in the room talking to the girls. Mary Ellen Lyons asked him where he'd been. Goggin said, Oh, don't even ask. We've been looking for boats. Lyons recalled, They said they had been down at the ferry landing swimming around. That the senator dove in the water because there was no ferry available for him and he wanted to get back to the other side. Because of his back, they said, they sort of instinctively dove in after him. And where was Mary Jo? One of the girls asked Goggin. Lyons said, He told me she was at the Katama Shores, that she had taken the car on the last ferry. Rosemary Keough had also asked Goggin where the senator and Mary Jo were. She testified later. He said not to worry about it. That Mary Jo and the senator had probably taken the ferry. Hard-pressed to explain his absence from the party and his disheveled appearance, Goggin had to keep the young women at the cottage. Should they return to their motel, they would know Mary Jo was missing and could raise the alarm. And that couldn't be done until the senator reported the accident. Goggin was trying to keep conversation about the accident to a minimum. I did not want to discuss what had happened. My attitude was one of being very negative, explaining nothing. The senator had indicated what he was going to do by his statement before he went into the water. My job was to do exactly what I was doing, which was to stay with the party and wait. Goggin lay down on the floor next to the screen door in the living room, to be the first to know if anybody came to the cottage. He had no idea of what to expect, but he was sure the senator was going to report the accident. I'm dealing with a guy I have some confidence in, he said later. If he dives in the water and says I'll take care of it, I may not know exactly what that means, but he's always acted responsibly. He's always been able to go forward with what he said he'd do in the past. So that's the thing to expect, that he's going to work it out. He's going to do what he's supposed to do, whatever that is. Gargan's expectations were based on the confidence I ascribed to him in the past, because I saw him right after Jack's assassination. I saw him after Bobby was killed. He was a man under control, terribly shocked from the loss of his brothers, but still able to function. I knew a confident, tough, disciplined guy who handled a crisis very well. That's the guy who took three steps and dove into the water. After an hour passed, Gargan wasn't so sure. He wondered if the senator had managed to report the accident without involving the party at the cottage, but he couldn't imagine how that would be possible. It occurred to him the senator might consult attorney Jack Driscoll at the Shiretown Inn about reporting the accident, he said. In fact, I was hopeful that he would. Gargan was aware of the stirrings of would-be sleepers in the living room behind him. Preoccupied by the death of Mary Jo and the senator's dilemma, he was increasingly apprehensive, unable to sleep. Several hours remained until dawn. Gargan took comfort from the thought that, in daylight, he would be able to figure out what the hell was going on. Markham, too, was suffering a turmoil of doubts about Ted Kennedy's intentions. When the senator dove in the water, neither he nor Gargan was sure what was going to happen, Markham said later. We hoped Ted was going to report the accident, but we didn't know for sure what he was going to do. We hadn't gotten a real commitment from him, so we were foggy on that point. In pain, unable to sleep, Markham walked out into the sultry darkness. He came back inside to sit in a rocking chair in front of the fireplace. He went outside again, stretching out on the back seat of the Valiant to try to get some sleep. It was dawn when Markham came back into the cottage. Gargan was awake, too. There were a lot of people up at this time, around 5 or 5:30, Gargan observed. Nobody slept very well. Gargan was anxious to get to Edgartown as quickly as possible. The first ferry went over at 7:30 a.m. He took Markham and Charles Tretter with him when he left the cottage. Rosemary Keogh and Susan Tannenbaum wanted to go along, too. Gargan regarded them as excess baggage, he said. I didn't want to talk to them, have them along or anything. I wanted to get away from them. But he couldn't refuse. Gargan left the Valiant at the landing and took the On Time to Edgartown. As he hurried up Daggett Street to the Shiretown Inn, Gargan made a determination, based on instinct, that the accident hadn't been reported. Gargan and Markham parted company with the others at the bottom of a stairway leading to a second-floor porch. Gargan said, "We'll see you." Rosemary Keogh recalled looking up and seeing Senator Kennedy standing on the porch outside his room. Chapter 14 Ross Richards was walking on North Water Street around 7:15 a.m. when he met Stan Moore. Moore had rented a room at the Harborside Hotel, in which a number of friends were staying. During some horseplay, one of the guests was thrown through a railing of a terrace, landing at the feet of a security guard. Moore and the others had been evicted from the premises, but not before having to pay damages, Moore related. Nobody had any money. We had to take up a collection before they'd let us leave. Moore had been wandering around Edgartown since 5 a.m. Richards and Moore encountered Ted Kennedy in the alley that separated the Shiretown Inn from the Colonial Inn next door. Kennedy joined them to walk back to the second-floor porch. The senator was coming from the inn's small lobby, where he had asked the desk clerk, Mrs. Frances Stewart, to reserve the Boston Globe and the New York Times. He said, "By the way, could I borrow a dime? I seem to have left my wallet upstairs." Mrs. Stewart produced a coin from the desk's cash drawer. Senator Kennedy was freshly shaven, dressed in yachting clothes. He appeared normal in every way when he walked 30 feet to an outside porch and the inn's only public telephone. Kennedy called Helga Wagner, a former German airline stewardess with whom he had established a romantic liaison. Kennedy told her nothing about the accident, Mrs. Wagner said later. "He just said something very serious had happened, and I need to have Stephen Smith's number in Spain. He knew I had it because I was on my way to Europe to join Stephen Smith and his wife Jean." Kennedy returned to the desk to give back the dime he'd borrowed. Flustered to be in the presence of a prominent person, Mrs. Stewart impulsively introduced herself. She was surprised how weak the senator's handshake was. Kennedy's skin felt cold and clammy to the touch. Ross Richards went into his room to awaken his wife. He said, "Ted's outside. He wants to see you. Why don't you get up?" A beautiful, slender blonde, Marilyn Richards complained, "Ross, it isn't 8 o'clock yet." When she joined the group on the porch, she observed Ted Kennedy was all dressed up. A quarter hour of innocuous conversation followed, she recalled. Mostly it was Stan Moore telling us about getting thrown out of the harborside. We were all chatting on the porch when Joey Gargan arrived. Mrs. Richards was surprised at Gargan's appearance. Joey looked awful. His clothes were all wrinkled and his hair was sticking out. Even more startling was the uncharacteristically loud and coarse manner with which Gargan announced his presence, demanding to speak to Ted Kennedy at once. Gargan was very definite about wanting to see him. My directness, my aggressiveness, the sense of urgency I had may have startled him. I more or less ordered him into the room. It was, "I'd like to see you right now. Get in there." In his haste to get to the Shiretown, Gargan had worked up a sweat. I was soaking wet because it was a hot, muggy morning, and I was very agitated and eager to find out what the hell was going on. After a sleepless night of mounting anxiety, Gargan's temperature had soared even higher when he'd looked up from the bottom of the stairs to see Ted Kennedy posturing on the porch, chatting unconcernedly with the others, pretending there was nothing wrong. From that tableau, it was clear to Gargan the senator hadn't reported the accident. It was obvious to Markham, too, that nothing had been done. There was no commotion. Markham went to Kennedy's room. The door was locked. The senator had left the key inside. Gargan went to the lobby to fetch another key. Ross Richards asked the senator to join him for breakfast. Kennedy said he couldn't right now, but he might join him later. Gargan returned with a key. Kennedy and Markham followed him to the room and closed the door. "What happened?" Markham said. Kennedy reclined on one of the room's twin beds. He said, "I didn't report it." Markham recalled, "When we got over there and found out he hadn't reported the accident, we almost shit. We couldn't believe he hadn't reported it." "What the fuck is going on?" Gargan exploded. "You were supposed to report the fucking accident." Kennedy had swum the channel. He had slipped into the Shiretown Inn unseen, changed clothes, and established his presence by asking an employee patrolling the premises the time. He had gone to bed and awakened around 7 o'clock. He had betrayed no sign of having been involved in an automobile accident to a number of witnesses. It wasn't too late for the scenario he had proposed to be put into effect. It wouldn't be difficult to convince people he hadn't known about the accident until the next morning. The senator had expected the incident to have been taken care of when Gargan and Markham showed up the next morning, that Gargan would have reported the accident and told the police Mary Jo Kopechne had been driving the accident car. The senator had counted on Gargan to realize, after an hour or so had passed and nobody showed up at the cottage, that he had no choice but to report the accident. It was, after all, the kind of clean-up detail Gargan customarily performed as advance man, a dependency that went back to the Joey-will-fix-it days of their boyhood. So long as there was a chance Gargan would reconsider his objections to the plan, the senator had not reported the accident himself. Gargan was mortified by his sense of the senator's motive for swimming the channel. To force him to follow a course he had made clear in the car he wanted followed, irrespective of Gargan's objections. That the accident had not been reported was bad enough. For the senator to have misrepresented his intentions by subterfuge, saying he was going to report the accident and then not doing so, and start putting an alibi into play, only compounded the tragedy, Gargan said. "This thing is worse now than it was before. We've got to do something. We're reporting the accident right now." Kennedy said, "I'm going to say that Mary Jo was driving." "There's no way you can say that," Gargan said. "You can be placed at the scene." Into the room burst Charlie Tretter. Furious at the interruption, Gargan told him, "Hey, you, get out of here." Tretterid looked through the room's window and thought the senator had motioned him inside. "I thought that in his eyes and in his face there was something wrong," he said later. "I thought he was angry or disturbed, but I didn't know whether it was at me for interfering with the conversation or what." When Tretter left, Gargan said, "Jesus! We've got to report this thing. Let's go." Kennedy was reluctant to do so, Markham observed. He was still stuck on the idea of having Mary Jo driving the car. The senator wanted to know where there was a telephone he could use. The telephone at the inn was in an inconvenient place. Other telephones in Edgartown were equally public, Gargan knew from years of regatta weekends. There would be 2-3 people lined up to use them. Time was of the essence in Gargan's view. "I was very anxious for the senator to get to a phone and do the things I thought he should do. Then report the accident." Gargan suggested the telephone at the ferry house on the Chappaquiddick Landing. Returning to the Shiretown Inn from a coffee shop where they had just breakfasted, Marilyn and Ross Richards passed Gargan, Markham, and the senator on their way to the ferry. They were obviously in a big rush and looked very preoccupied, Marilyn Richards observed. "They passed us without a greeting." The senator appeared untroubled on the short ride to Chappaquiddick. He went into the ferry house to call Dave Burke, to alert him to take care of all the details that had to be taken care of, Gargan said, because now, obviously, the story was going to go out. Gargan didn't hear the conversation. That the senator was still reluctant to report the accident was clear to Markham from what he overheard. Markham observed a tow truck's flashing lights bound for Chappaquiddick on board the On Time. He went inside the ferry house to bring the vehicle to Ted's attention, an indication the accident car had been discovered at Dyke Bridge. Gargan had spotted the truck, too. "Now it was essential to report the accident," he said. "You've got to do what I've been saying right along. Get your ass over there and report it as fast as you can." Gargan suggested Markham accompany the senator to the police station. Under normal circumstances, Gargan would have done it. But he was determined not to be a party to any false report. So long as there was a thread of hope that somebody else could be driving the accident car, the senator would cling to that hope. Gargan didn't want to be placed in the position, if the senator started to lie, of having to contradict him, or be forced to go along with whatever story he was going to tell police. Gargan got into the Valiant parked at the landing to drive to the cottage. On the way, he encountered La Rosa, Crimmins, the Lyons sisters, and Esther Newberg walking on Chappaquiddick Road, heading for the landing. Gargan stopped the car and told them to get in. Looking at Gargan's face, Nance Lyons knew that something was wrong. She said, "What's happened?" "There's been an accident," Gargan said, but he wouldn't say anything else until he had returned to the cottage and the others were seated in the living room. "The senator has been in an automobile accident," he said, "and we can't find Mary Jo." Gargan refused to answer any questions. "I didn't know what had happened, so what I'm telling these people is limited." Gargan ordered Crimmins and La Rosa, "Get all the stuff together, every bottle, every potato chip. I want this place cleaned up immediately." He would return to pick them up later. Nance Lyons found Mary Jo's handbag under a chair in the living room, she said. "Her pocketbook happened to be next to mine, and I took it when I was collecting my own things." Gargan was repeatedly questioned about the accident on the way to the landing. Where was the accident? What had been done about it? Had the Coast Guard been called? Gargan had no details, he said. "Can't you do something?" Nance Lyons said. "Isn't there some way we can have somebody else as driver of the car?" "That would be impossible," Gargan said. "I don't know why you couldn't be driving the car," Lyons said. "Can't somebody else take the blame? There's no way we can do that?" "Of course not," Gargan said. "That's absolutely out of the question." It dawned on Gargan. "God damn it, Joe. You were smart not to tell anybody about the accident last night, because you would have gotten everybody involved. They would have been making plans to have somebody else drive the car, and God knows what else. The damn thing would have been a total disaster." Nance Lyons persisted. "Why can't we have somebody else driving the car?" "We can't, that's all. Gargan said bluntly, putting an end to the discussion. The senator was driving. Gargan left the girls at the Edgartown dock to take a cab to their motel. He told them to stay calm. He would call later with details. Gargan went to the police station to find out what was going on. The senator and Paul Markham were working on an accident report. Gargan didn't get a chance to talk to them. From the crowd gathered outside Town Hall, he realized this thing was going to be highly investigated. Gargan had some understanding the accident car had been found. But nobody specifically told me we found Mary Jo in the car. At the Shiretown Inn, Gargan suggested Tretter take LaRose's Mercury to return Rosemary Keough and Susan Tannenbaum to the Gautama Shores Motel. When the Lyons sisters and Esther Newberg arrived at the motel, they'd gone into Mary Jo Kopechne's room expecting to find her there. Gargan had used the word tragedy to describe the accident. He hadn't said Mary Jo was dead, only that she was missing. Newberg said, "We girls kept hoping Mary Jo had somehow gotten out of the car too, that maybe she was alive and wandering around dazed." Tretter showed up with Keough and Tannenbaum. He said, "One of the girls already there came out of a room and said, 'There's been an accident. Something's happened to Mary Jo.'" Rosemary Keough was told, "The senator drove off a bridge and we don't know where Mary Jo is," she recalled later. "We said, 'How could it have happened? Does anybody know anything?' And nobody did."
Tretter returned to the Shiretown Inn. Gargan told him about the accident.
Tretter was shaking his head, muttering, "Oh, God," over and over. He said to Gargan, "I think you ought to go out and talk to the girls. They're upset. They don't know what to do." Gargan intended to do that anyway. "I wanted to get them off the island as soon as possible. How I was going to do that, I wasn't sure." Gargan called the Gautama Shores and talked to Nance Lyons. She asked him if the accident car had been recovered. Gargan said it had. "I asked if Mary Jo had been in the car, and he said, 'Yes,'" Lyons said later. Gargan was coming to the motel to explain. Gargan showed up around 11 o'clock. The senator's car had gone off Dyke Bridge, he told the girls. The senator had dived repeatedly to rescue Mary Jo. Apparently she was dead. "I want you to know," he said, "that every single effort possible was made to save her." Gargan didn't mention his own rescue efforts, Tretter recalled. He said the senator had called him and Markham out of the cottage to tell what had happened, and asked to be driven to the Edgartown ferry. The senator was distraught. Neither one of them had talked to him. He was just saying, "Get me to Edgartown. Get me to Edgartown." Tretter observed, "A tremendous emotional breakdown of the girls around me, so that for 5 or 10 minutes there was nothing but crying." "The girls' reaction was not pleasant," Gargan said. "They were highly critical. Some of them were very angry. They had not been told about the accident when he returned to the cottage." Gargan was even more evasive than he had been at the cottage, "because now I had the additional problem I didn't have the night before. The senator is at the police station making his report of what happened in the accident. I don't want to say anything to these girls that would compromise whatever statement he was making. Plus, I had very little knowledge about the accident itself, except for Paul and I doing the diving. How much or any of that the senator is going to tell the police, I didn't know. The only thing relevant to the report was how the accident had taken place, how fast the senator was driving, where he was coming from, and where he was going when he got to the bridge," Gargan said. "And I had no knowledge of any of that." Having defended automobile accident cases for insurance companies for many years, Gargan was certain Kennedy would be sued. "First, I was thinking of this as a civil case. And in addition to that, manslaughter definitely had to be considered, since Mary Jo had died in an accident. Because it's automatic in Massachusetts when a person is killed in an accident for the prosecutor to bring an action for criminal manslaughter. You've got to have a hearing." Now that I saw the magnitude of the situation, I was even less willing to give the girls any information. My client, so to speak, although he was sort of a semi-client, is now at the police station giving his report. I don't want anything I said at that time to change whatever factual situation he was presenting.
I was in no position as a lawyer who had advised the senator to report the accident to discuss the case with anybody, since it had now become a case. Gargan told the girls, "I think what you should do is get off the island as soon as possible. Nobody knows at the moment that any of you